Hi, everyone, and welcome to Academic Dean, where we connect with passionate college leaders who share their stories and viewpoints of higher education, especially lessons learned along the way. Now, here's your host, Dr. Dave Gercheck.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Rafael Castella to our show. Dr. Castella is the provost at Eastwick College in Ramsey, New Jersey. Hi, how you doing? You look good on this nice, brisk winter morning or afternoon now.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you for inviting me. Indeed, it's fairly cold in New Jersey, but we've had a wonderful winter in that we have not seen snow. And I don't want to say this because I'm kind of jinxing myself, but snow is one of those things that is beautiful to see the very first time, and that's it.
Yeah, I'm in Montana, and it's the same thing. We haven't had too bad of a winter, but it's getting ready to hit us again. So, you know, keep your fingers crossed.
Yes.
So first, tell me about Eastwick College and why students select your institution.
All right. So Eastwick College is a New Jersey private proprietary institution of higher education. We are authorized to offer programs through the associate degree and to exceed our mission to offer several bachelor degree programs in healthcare, mainly cardiovascular sonography and nursing. We have about 2,000 students distributed in three campuses in northern New Jersey. If we consider our overall history from the time that we were career-oriented institutions, we've had about 50,000 graduates that we have contributed to the New York metro area. And we have programs in healthcare, business, and technology. I can tell you that our students are very diverse. We have 84% students who are female. About 78% of the students come from New Jersey, about 20% from New York counties. And the reminder from some of the nearby states in the New York metro area. And again, a very diverse population. About 61% of our population is not white. And in terms of age, we have a lot of non-traditional students ranging, about 52% of our students range in age between 25 and 50, 30% between 30 and 50. A lot of them are first generation in college. Many are here because they're pursuing career changes. Some have been unsuccessful with previous colleges, college experience, and have credits that they want to use and they want to transfer into some of our programs. So, it's convenient for them because we are a commuting institution. So they are able to continue on with their lives, with their jobs, with their families. In the last few years, we introduced the hybrid modality for a significant portion of our courses. There are, of course, no room on board course, so it's very convenient for them. They don't have to stop whatever they're doing to come to college. They can just combine the two. Other reasons why our students come, I think although we are proprietary, what in the sector is known as for-profit, which is a term that I probably don't like to use, but we have a very, very good model in that we have an integral tuition model. Students pay a flat tuition fee, a flat tuition with no added fees other than registration and application. We provide laptops at no additional cost. We provide all textbooks at no additional cost. We've in fact frozen our tuition since 2013. And even at times the tuition has changed, we've always had the policy that the tuition is frozen for the entire enrollment period of that student. Compared to the more traditional sector where students have to seek an advisor and figure out what courses to take, what courses not to take, we do prescribe schedules. We have very specific outlines for each of our programs, and we tell students exactly what they're going to be studying term after term. And So they know what to expect and they know how to prepare for that. And we follow a quarterly calendar. So that results in programs that are shorter. And they're going to be out and about making money out of what they learned much sooner than the traditional semester-based system of the traditional sector. We have so many relationships with the providers, healthcare providers and business providers in the tri-state area, so that we can assure students that they're going to have their rotations, whether they call field roles or externships, that are part of certain programs, and they're going to be able to complete their labs and all of the program's activities within the scheduled time. So there are no surprises there. And I think over the years, because the institution in its various brandings before it became degree granting has been in the market since 1968, we've built a reputation and a brand name that is also another reason why students come to us.
Oh, good. So since you mentioned 52% of your students are non-traditional, which is really kind of a high number for a college. Of course, I think it's becoming more of the norm for a lot of the colleges and universities throughout the U.S., but what do you do specifically for that population? How do you make their transition into college easier than the traditional students?
Well, the first thing is that we have a very good policy, transfer credit policy. We take care of evaluating their previous credits, see how they match to courses in our programs. It's a very fair policy that allows them to transfer coursework they've completed elsewhere. And that's probably a hallmark of our institution, is that we don't do remedial work. We don't believe in remedial work. Students begin, when a student is admitted into the program, students in the program, unlike more traditional institutions that may have the student first go through a lot of remedial courses that are going to take a lot of time and money before considering them for admission into especially health care related programs. We do admit them into the program from the get-go, and then we work with them. If they need additional assistance, then our academic advisors, our tutors, work with them to bring them up to speed and to make sure that they're going to be able to meet the rigor of our programs. And we provide an environment that they become very comfortable. In fact, we have a good number of students that come back. They graduate from a shorter program. They come back for a degree program. They come back for a higher degree program and so forth. And we see sometimes their children coming here to take programs because they know the environment, they feel comfortable in it, and they know that they can reach any of us at any time. We have an open door policy in every one of our offices. So any student can feel confident that they can share any issues that they have with regard to their success in school, or maybe consult one of our academic advisors regarding outside problems that get in the way of their success, related to family, related to work, related to mental health issues. And we are going to work with them and refer them to the right resources because ultimately we want them to be successful, and we want them to get out of here and get a job, get gainful employment that is going to change their lives for the better.
You know, I really like that idea. I know as a dean, I can't tell you how many students that would complain about having to take so many classes before they take the other classes, and they're all remedial classes, and you could just see the air go out of their tires, their excitement. I mean, it was just like, it was such a battle. You know, it's just like college is hard enough just to take the regular classes, let alone the remedial. So you're kind of unique. Not a lot of colleges and universities are looking at that model, but I think that's an excellent model for especially non-traditional students.
Yeah, I think so. And something else that we like to do for all of our programs is that we do our best to introduce core courses from the very beginning of the curriculum sequence. So that engages them, and that is interesting for them, because that's what they came here for. You know, to have them going through general education courses for terms before they start the course sequence, they may lose interest. They may not be as engaged. Of course, all these general education requirement, which mostly is state mandated, is there and it serves a purpose. But I think that including core courses at the beginning of the sequence has always been something that they like and that helps them succeed.
Yeah, they feel engaged in their program if they're taking actual mm-hmm. program classes at the very yes. beginning. Yeah, that's a great idea. What's new at the college?
Well, we're always trying to find new ways to develop the college, to develop the programs. In the last few years, we've been looking for ways to offer bachelor degree programs, but always with a career focus. And that's key in our sector. Everything is career oriented. So the most recent program that we got approved and we just started is a bachelor's degree in nursing. But it's a bit different than other bachelor degrees in nursing. Ours is an LPN to BSN program. So we identified during the research process 23,000 licensed LPNs in the state of New Jersey, and only two institutions that were offering a similar program. And they were graduating fewer than 20 students a year. And we also have a long history back to 2003 of educating licensed practical nurses at two campuses. So the need was there. Of course, we all know that nurses are dying needed everywhere in the country, and especially after the pandemic that was so clear. And right now we started the program in October, and we're very excited about that. I think that's going to not only contribute to the needs of the community, to the needs of the state and the country, but give these opportunity to a sector that is not always considered by the traditional colleges and universities when it comes to educational opportunities.
Well, once again, you're unique. You know, I see RN to BSN and I see LPN to RN, but I haven't seen very many LPN to BSN.
Yes. And one advantage of this is that we work our schedules so that they can continue working as LPNs. And their wages are really good as LPNs. And in fact, not too long ago, there was a study that showed that New Jersey LPNs are the highest paid LPNs in the state of New Jersey and some of the highest in the country. So they can take care of their families. They can have a job that's fulfilling, that pays them good money while they continue their education. We've always promoted that idea to have stackable credentials. Student can come here, say, for medical assisting, use the earnings for that for medical assisting to make a living, to build a family, and some years later, maybe that student is interested in stepping up to LPN. Maybe years later, stepping up to BSN. So we're excited with that. In the last almost 2 years, we've also had a very interesting program, which is a study abroad program in Israel. We have worked with the Orthodox Jewish community in Lakewood, New Jersey, to create a business program with a focus on hospitality that includes a study abroad program where students go to Israel to complete some of their general education requirements that are geared towards the Jewish culture in Israel. So that's also a very interesting path that we've gotten involved with in the last few years. And at the institutional level, the accreditation is always a big deal, for all of us working in academia. And the history, because of the mission and what these institutions were before they were degree granting, we've been accredited by what we used to call institutional accreditors. Now, there used to be institutional and regional accreditors. That regional distinction was removed recently, so now everybody's an institutional accreditor, but we are seeking accreditation by the Middle States Commission on Higher Education, which, of course, is a very prestigious one, is the agency that accredits so many of the best institutions in the nation, in the world, in this region. So that's a major institutional effort that we have been going through in the last 2 years. And we are progressing the right way in terms of that process. So, of course, right now, we are sort of in the hangover from the pandemic. We are recovering from all the adjustments that we had to do to keep functioning during the pandemic, to keep servicing our students. We did well. We did not have any major impact, and we're very lucky for that. Of course, I think we're nimble as an institution. We were able to adapt nearly overnight to the rigors of the pandemic, and we're just ready to keep going and looking for more programs and more ways to serve students in the community.
Well, I know you've been at Eastwick for a long time, but can you talk about your path that led you to your current position as provost there?
Well, it's quite long because I used to say I invaded the U.S. 25 years ago. I'm Colombian. I'm a physician. I went to medical school in Colombia, and I worked as a physician in a new trend at the time called aesthetic medicine that later became a formal specialty. But I'm also a product of the post-secondary sector, in that my family enterprise was one that combined a business that related to importation to Colombia of medical and aesthetic equipment. But my father was a big entrepreneur, and he also created the first school of aesthetics in Colombia back then. And we had a program that was about 2 years in length, a post-secondary program in aesthetics. So while I was in medical school, near completion in medical school, I took advantage of a teaching opportunity and began teaching medical courses that were part of that curriculum. When I graduated, I set up my practice in the same campus, and I became the director of the program. And I created a new program in aesthetic medicine for physicians of Colombia and nearby countries. So we created a lot of continuing education activities, a lot of special courses for physicians and for estheticians. And we contributed significantly to the development of aesthetic medicine in Colombia. Then near, I would say around late 96, you know, things got difficult in the country in terms of a huge recession. Sometimes working with a family is not as easy as it seems. So I made the decision to seek other options. I had family in the U.S. I had very close friends in the U.S. And I had this opportunity. I got sponsored for a work visa to come work with this organization that, the global name of the organization is Eastwick Education. And at the time, the organization had several career schools in New Jersey. So I began teaching medical courses, similar to the medical courses I was teaching in Colombia. And I did so for about 7 years. So combining my teaching experience in Colombia and in the U.S., I taught for about 15 years. Then I had an opportunity when the academic dean of one of the campuses retired to become the academic dean of the Ramsey campus. And that was probably early 2003. And that started a period of huge change, because a major project for the organization was to convert the Ramsey campus into a college. We felt that we had accomplished a great deal. We had a good reputation in the state, especially in the cardiovascular field, and that it was the right time to seek becoming a college. So we went through that process between 2006 and 2008. In October of 2008, the Ramsey campus became Eastwood College. The previous name was Hohokus School, then it became Eastwood College. And several years later, we added the Hackensack campus that had was also another Hohokus School. And a few years later, the Nutley campus, again, another Hohokus School. So the three campuses became Eastwood College. And during that time, my position changed. Because in the beginning, I was the Associate Dean of Academics, then the Dean of Academics, then the Corporate Director of Education. At some point, I became the VP for Academic Affairs, and then my current position of Provost and Executive Vice President of the college. But again, like me, I have several, many colleagues in the organization that have been here for a very, very long time, faculty that have been here for a very long time. And I think that creates an environment that works well, not only for us, of course, but for the students, because there's a familiarity, there is a sense that we know what the mission of the institution is, the kinds of students that we have and how to serve them well. That has been interesting all these years.
Well, what are the biggest lessons you've learned as an academic leader over the years?
Well, I think that to me it's really all about collaboration. I've had my share of failures, my share of problems, my share of successes too. Although I had been used to working in academic environments of this kind from my Colombian experience, of course, when you come to the U.S., then you have all this cultural shock, and you have to adapt to it, and you have to learn to work with it. We Colombians are the royalty of sarcasm. Sarcasm is a way of life there. So we have to, I had to get rid of that. I had to learn to interact in a way that was positive and always seeking the feedback from my faculty, the feedback from other staff that work alongside me and just make sure that whatever we put together is something that has everybody's consensus. And I now think that it's all about persuading, never imposing. But also in terms of my interaction or our interaction with regulators, because I mean, this is almost like the central for all kinds of interactions with regulators at the local, state, level, institutional accreditation, programmatic accreditation. So it's very important to always be very well informed, but always be able to question things, to question them in a professional manner, but to question them because, more often than not, we've had, regulators that, have their own, I assume, have their own agendas, or they are creating what I call regulations on the go that are not really in their standards, written in their standards. So I always want to make sure that I want to question what they're telling me, and that we promote the idea that everybody in the organization has to be familiar with all the regulatory framework, has to be familiar with the characteristics of the institution, with the strategic goals of Eastwood College, with the assessment results that we obtain from our various activities, so that they feel part of the organization and they feel that commitment to the organization and its students.
Well, let's change topics. What do you think are going to be the major challenges that colleges are going to face over the next 5 years?
Well, I guess by now, you know, I'm very career oriented, and I guess my orientation comes from my time in Colombia. even traditional education there is fairly career oriented. I was exploring the other day some big programs at some of the biggest, the best higher education institutions there that are as good as the best here. And when you look at, for instance, the percent of general education in their curricula, it's about 10%. Now, in New Jersey, if I want to establish a bachelor's degree program, I have to, I'm obligated to give 50% of the curriculum in general education. So that's sometimes difficult to convey to prospective students because they say, well, I want to be a nurse. Why do I have to take all these English courses and all these other courses that pertain to general education? So I think that's difficult. It's important to be able to convey the value of higher education to our prospective students because, you know, many of them are going to get into some kind of debt and it needs to be justified. Now, we have been very lucky that our programs are very purposeful, that our programs really serve the needs of the students and the community, and our levels of student debt are very low. Our default rates are very low, are in the low single digits for every one of our campuses. So students are able to make a living from what they learned here and pay back their loans successfully. So I think one of the challenges is to produce programs that have that value proposition. Recently, there was an organization called Stacker, a website, stacker.com, that sort of interprets data from different studies to present it to the public in a more manageable way. And they conducted a study of Georgetown University on return on investment. And Eastwood College Ramsey came up among, they put us together with the community colleges, but it came up among the 100 institutions in the nation with the highest return of investment. Again, because these programs are really triggered or targeted to the needs of the community. You know, I also have a business background. I have an MBA in my educational background, so I'm always thinking both ways, but when you look at education, you really have two products. One product is your program, and the other product is the student. And you have two clients. One client is the student, the other client is the community. So you need to make sure that whatever you offer is really going to serve those constituencies well. I think enrollment, I mean, there have been enrollment declines. We blame the pandemic, but who knows in the future if that's going to continue, because training is going to come from other sources. We have things like Coursera, or we have corporations that are providing training that are doing micro-credentialing. And that's probably a trend that might take away students from the general education sector. Engagement is important. And after the pandemic, online became so prevalent. But, I mean, not everybody is well suited for strictly online education. That takes a lot of engagement, a lot of will on part of the students. So I think those are key challenges. One of the ways we've tackled the issue of online versus in-person is that we decided that we did not want to have strictly online courses. All of our courses are hybrid, because that way they come to campus to testing to ensure that the integrity of our tests. Of course, there are many courses that have hands-on components, so they have to come to labs. But also, there may be selective activities, certain lectures that are better off to be conducted on campus. So I think that way we maintain the engagement. We also have a better opportunity to establish personal relationships with our students, and to keep them engaged through the end of the programs, and to limit attrition.
Well, what do you think opportunities will look like for higher ed institutions in the future then?
I think in the big scheme of things, opportunities have a lot to do with relationships between higher education institutions and the community and the industry, how to engage with them for credentialing. to provide very targeted types of training that are going to serve the needs of those organizations. It's also what students need. Sometimes they need very specific additional skills and knowledge that can be provided with a short program, not necessarily with a full degree. So that's an area where probably institutions have to look further. We try to work that a great deal. We are constantly interacting with our advisory boards, with the organizations that relate to our programs, to see how we can serve them better. Sometimes it's in terms of customized training. Sometimes it may be some kind of tweak to our program, so the curriculum includes concepts or training that is relevant to the current needs of the workplace.
Well, when I look at campuses today, they're a little bit different than they were, 20 years ago into the area of even, the students' mental health. I remember it wasn't that long ago. It was like, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. I mean, it just didn't seem that campuses provided mental health counseling or anything like that. Today, it seems like the students kind of expect that coming into campuses. So what are you guys doing to meet the needs of those mental health issues that students are now struggling with?
I think it's, again, all about relationships. We do not have mental health counselors per se, licensed mental health counselors, but we do have academic advisors, and which are the majority of our faculty. And we have them go through the training of NACADA, the National Academic Counselors Association. And we make sure that we establish those relationships, that students know somebody in the institution that they can talk to, that they can mention, the problems they have, or that they get in the way of their success. And in that sense, it's very distributed. And again, the faculty play the most important role. They need to engage with the students when they identify that there are potential issues, whether because they perceive it based on their experience or because their students have told them, they begin the advising process. They engage with them and with academic deans in order to look at what they need. If they need outside resources, we refer them to those outside resources, especially when it has to do with healthcare or childcare or things that college itself cannot fix. But that kind of engagement is key. Nothing could be worse than a student who's having issues and has nobody to talk to, that doesn't feel that he or she cannot trust anybody in the college to get some advice. It's not perfect, but I think it's an important way to go.
Yeah. Well, here's a fun question. If you had extra budget money right now with no strings attached, how would you spend it?
Well, I think that, first of all, learning resources. I love technology. I've been a proponent of technology for the whole time that I've been an administrator here. Of course, technology and healthcare get along very well. Now, a lot of what happens in healthcare education has to do with simulation. And we made great strides in acquiring all kinds of simulators that supplement the learning that students need to acquire before they go on to clinical sites. Faculty development is key. Ever since I was little, I always thought, well, there are people who may have the best resume in terms of the professional experience. They may know a lot, but if they don't know how to convey that information in a way that students can get, then it's not going to be very useful. So we spend a lot in faculty development, and if I had extra money, that would be an area where it would certainly go. And then student advising. Anything and everything we can do, just precisely we have so many students that are non-traditional. And unlike, say, my time as a student back in Colombia, where I was single. I didn't have any obligations. All I had to do was perform as a student. These days, we have the majority of our students who are parents, who have jobs, who have maybe sick parents at home, or maybe they have a disabled child. So they have so many things that get in the way that anything that we can do to supplement that student advice is going to be money well spent.
Well, here's my last question. Do you have any favorite books on leadership that you would recommend to other academic leaders?
I don't. I have a particular view of leadership. I mean, it's something that I have studied, particularly during my MBA training. But I read a lot of things on leadership from numerous sources. I'm a fan of these resources on websites and phones that are aggregators of news, so that I can choose from multitude of sources, from multitude of views, from all sides of the political spectrum. But and I read my share of leadership. But I think in that sense, what I've tried to do is look at the leaders that I have had during my personal and professional life and try to move away from the things that were not good and to try to do the things that were good and that were positive. And then look at my own experience and see how I can correct my mistakes, how I can interact better. So, no particular publication, but I always think that in terms of leadership, it's always find a way to make others shine. Never take credit for things you have not done. Always give it. And always be willing to say I'm wrong and to correct the course. You know, sometimes that's the problem. I've lost a lot of pride all these years. Sometimes unintentionally, oftentimes purposefully, because in the end, what's important is to learn from mistakes and to improve and to be a leader is not really somebody who imposes, but somebody who promotes, somebody who develops people so that they become their best.
That's a good place to end our conversation today. Rafael, thanks so much for being on our show. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Dave, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Well, that wraps up today's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks for listening to today's episode, and make sure to visit our website at academicdean.com for additional information. Also, if you enjoy our podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Until next time.